Hope you're enjoying the beautiful sunshine today. I appreciated Mr. Booth's reference to fall. I saw a funny post on Facebook this week from a friend in another part of the country who said, if you're wondering what happened to fall this year, it happened last Thursday and Friday. Now it's winter. Seems to be kind of the way the year has gone, both in the spring and in the fall. Well, to begin this message, I'd like to reference back to another recent message here in Indianapolis by Mr. Don Turgeon. He gave a really excellent sermon about the purpose of the struggles and challenges that we often face in our imperfect human lives. I was already thinking about and outlining this message at the time, which was great, because I think this fits very well as kind of an addendum or an appendix to the message that he gave. When we talk about the natural questions that surround our trials and difficulties, why we have them and the purposes for them in the big picture of life, there is another question that's often also present. Sometimes this question rages to the forefront and overshadows our desire to understand meaning and purpose. Sometimes this question stays in the background, maybe for a long time, and we don't even fully realize that it's there or how deeply it affects us. We had the opportunity to go to preteen Camp Ironwood this year, and one of the responsibilities that Mandy and I had was to host an evening campfire on the first night of camp. During that campfire session for the oldest dorms and the teens who were working as staff members, we facilitated a question and answer session where we handed out slips of paper and pens and encouraged the participants to ask literally anything that was on their minds. One of the participants asked this question, or a version of this question that we all have about trials and difficulties. And we asked the participants not to include their names, only their groups, so we don't know the specific person, only that it was a teen. And since the handwriting on this slip of paper is so neat and easy to read, it's reasonable to infer that this was a teen girl instead of a teen boy. Regardless of that, the question they wrote was, why is life so hard for certain people but easy for others? Why is life so hard for certain people but easy for others? Yeah, we don't know who this was, but it's probably also reasonable to infer that this young person may have asked this question because life has been harder for them in some way. And regardless of their specific circumstances, the heart and the root of that question or other versions of it is about the age-old concept of fairness. If we're honest, we humanly think about fairness all the time. I can tell you for sure that it's a hot topic of debate in our household on a daily basis with the kids. We verbalize it constantly when we're young, and when we grow up, we don't stop thinking about it. We just don't verbalize it nearly as often anymore. The most natural and common angle for us to approach the topic from is encapsulated, of course, in the very common statement, that's not fair. That's not fair. Somehow we all seem to grow up with this kind of instinctive sense of justice that easily identifies the smallest hint of something that isn't fair for us, while at the same time being fairly oblivious to things that aren't fair for others, especially when we're young. Most of us then mature throughout the course of our lives to a much more balanced view on fairness, yet especially when the difficulties and the challenges arise or when we're not getting our way, and we find ourselves again saying, that's not fair. So as Mr. Turgeon phrased it in his recent sermon about why life is the way it is, hopefully today we can review some basic truths about the topic of fairness. From the time we have remaining then, let's address both what the Bible says about this important subject and what our perspective on it should be when it most commonly arises. So what does the Bible say about fairness? We'll cover a few principles on how we should view the topic as Christians. But first, let's begin by defining our own common use of the term. From the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary, there are three meanings of the word fair that would be relevant in this context. The first of those meanings is marked by impartiality and honesty, free from self-interest, prejudice, or favoritism. So this meaning would apply in statements like, that's a fair arrangement, or that's a fair response, or maybe that person was treated fairly. So it implies some impartiality and nothing out of kilter happening. The second meaning with relevance would be conforming with established rules. So this would apply in statements like, the game was played fairly, or the judge rendered a fair verdict. And the third and final meaning is consonant or in harmony with merit or importance. So this would be used in statements like, that's a fair salary, or that person received a fair reward for their effort. Now, taken together, these definitions all carry the strong implication of things turning out the way that they should be, or the way that they're supposed to, as we might commonly say. Unfortunately, as we all know from experience, lots of things aren't the way that they're supposed to be, and they don't turn out the way that they should. Why is that? Let's remind ourselves of four basic biblical principles that contribute to the reality of our life's experiences that can easily be viewed, especially from our human perspective, as not fair. The first of those principles is that we live in a world that is temporary and imperfect by design. We live in a world that is temporary and imperfect by design. Regardless of how we think things should be in this life, or wish that they were, there is a base level of physical imperfection that, to borrow Mr. Snyder's term from the Feast of Trumpets, is baked into the very fabric of our existence. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and we'll read verse 1. Here Paul writes, "For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." So here Paul was writing that our very own bodies, the thing most dear and most near to us, most close and most personal, that they are like tents. Now, even the nicest of tents is still a temporary dwelling, as anyone who's ever stayed in a tent becomes keenly aware of. Paul goes on to contrast these tents, our bodies, with a more permanent structure in the spiritual, eternal realm, a spirit body that is made with a different essence and a different nature. In the King James translation of verse 1, the word translated as tent in the New King James is tabernacle. We just kept the Feast of Tabernacles, a feast that is all about temporary dwellings and the transformation that must occur between our temporary imperfect existence and membership in the eternal God family. This is the same truth that Paul was writing about. He was saying that by the very nature of our physical lives, they cannot fulfill this eternity that our hearts desire, as described by the author of Ecclesiastes. And a lot of times that seems like it's not fair. The second principle is that we live in a world that is filled with external limitations. We live in a world filled with external limitations. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 9. Ecclesiastes 9, and read verse 11. Here the author writes, "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. Why? But time and chance happen to them all." Now, the overall context of this section in chapter 9 is that eventually death comes to us all. In verse 11, the author is articulating a principle that's certainly applicable for that theme, but also has great relevance during the course of our lives. The Nelson Study Bible comments on verse 11 summarize it this way. It says, quote, "We would like to think that the best always win and that the deserving are always rewarded. But our experience shows that these expectations are not always realized." And isn't that an understatement? Indeed, we can observe just an endless list of occurrences during the course of our lives that don't turn out the way that they should, due to an endless list of circumstances that are beyond the control of those impacted. Now, contrary to the beliefs of some, the day-to-day outcomes of our lives are not predestined or predetermined, especially when it comes to routine occurrences. God is certainly active in guiding the course and the outcome of our lives. But does that mean that everything that happens in the course of our lives, no matter how minute, has intentionally been brought about by God? Well, no, it doesn't. So how can we understand those two seemingly contradictory parameters of life? Well, as in so many cases, the pattern that we observe through the experience of being parents or maybe even just caretakers in our human realm provides some context that we can make sense of. As a parent or as a caretaker, we do very much guide and influence the overall outcome of another person's life. However, as every parent or caretaker knows, you are not in control of everything that happens in the other person's life, nor ultimately would you really want to be, for lots of reasons. So exposure to the impact of time and chance, both the good things that happen and for the bad things that happen, that's simply a baseline reality of our physical lives. And again, sometimes that seems like it's not fair. The third principle is that we live in a world with other beings who have free will. We live in a world with other beings who have free will. This principle may be the most impactful of the four. In addition to the unique capabilities of conscious thought and emotions that are connected to a conscience that make us human, we have also been endowed with free will, or free moral agency, as it's sometimes called. Our lives are filled with interactions with other living beings who also have free will. And we all enjoy the personal benefits of having free will, but we often forget what it really means, both for ourselves and our interactions with others. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 30. Deuteronomy chapter 30, review a fundamental truth on this topic. Deuteronomy 30, verse 15. This is God speaking, and he says, "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil." Just let that soak in for a minute. "I have set before you today both life and good, death and evil." Verse 19. "I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death and blessing and cursing." Whether we like it or not, free will means that anyone can choose to do anything, for good or for bad, for better or for worse, for right or for wrong, whatever the consequences, whatever the cost. Of course, as we could read in Deuteronomy 30 further, God tells us which way is good and which way is bad, and he even pleads with us to choose the right way. But the point is that we are allowed to choose either one. Do our own choices and the choices of others impact our perception of how fair life is? You bet they do. In fact, several of the more popular methods in the past few years within the atheist movement for attacking and criticizing belief in God and religion in general are really based on exploiting a one-sided view of the perceived lack of fairness in life that's really due to the consequences of human choice and free will. The fourth principle that impacts our perception and experience of fairness is that we tend to perceive that life is more fair or less unfair for others than it is for us. We tend to perceive that life is more fair or less unfair for others than it is for us. In reality, other people have far more difficulties and challenges than we think. Often they are just under the surface of what we normally see in our daily interactions with others at work or at school, and yes, even here at church. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 2. There's a couple of passages in Ecclesiastes that describe this principle well. Ecclesiastes 2. Starting in verse 13, the author says, "Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, so contrasting the two, yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart," verse 15, "as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity." Chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes. Chapter 9, starting in verse 2. "All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath as he who fears an oath." Verse 3, "This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all." Again, the overall context of some of these verses is that eventually death comes to us all, but there's a very powerful and accurate application of these observations in the process of life that we experience as well. We have individual strengths and weaknesses, successes and failures, blessings and trials. Our lives aren't exactly the same. But ultimately, we all have the same race to run. And we all face the same reality that life is often difficult for us all in one way or another. So what can we do then with the knowledge that these four principles, imperfection by design, time and chance, free will, and our own perception, that these four principles impact both our perceptions and the reality of what we experience with regard to fairness? On a pretty regular basis, either we feel that life isn't fair, or it truly isn't in one way or another. So how can we maintain a healthy and balanced perspective when faced with those realities? For the most part, the Bible doesn't address this topic using words and verbiage that, you know, just exactly equate to our use of the words fair and unfair. But there are multiple principles in the Scriptures that can inform and influence our views and our understanding of the topic away from our natural human perspective, which often gets us into trouble, and toward God's perspective instead. So in that light, let's look at four principles that we can use to manage our own feelings and perceptions and actions when it comes to fairness. The first of those principles is to remember that what we receive in life is not what we deserve. Remember that what we receive in life is not what we deserve. If we start by remembering that the promised outcome of the individual and collective human lives, according to God's plan of salvation, will be eternal life in His family for as many as will accept it. It's a value to also remember that it's not because that's the outcome that we deserve. In fact, quite the opposite. The Bible is clear in passages such as Romans 3:23 and Romans 6:23 that what we have all earned or deserved is death due to sin. In spite of that, though, we have an incredible opportunity to be spared from that penalty by the grace of God and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. it can be very easy to get bent out of shape, as we say, because we think we're not getting something that we deserve, whether it's love, respect, or material things, whatever the case may be. Many times that may, in fact, be true. In lots of cases, we may well not be receiving some of the things that we ought to be. Nevertheless, we should be very cautious and careful in our thoughts and words, because ultimately we should all be eternally grateful that we won't get the final outcome that we truly deserve because of God's mercy for us. The second principle is to be careful what you wish for. The old adage that's so true, be careful what you wish for. Another reason to use caution is that many of our thoughts and actions about what we deserve tend to be based on comparing ourselves with others, which is always dangerous. The problem with comparing what we have and how we are treated with others is that our assumptions about what others have and how they are treated are often incorrect. And human nature tends to lead us to assume that others possess a little more and have fewer difficulties and problems than they actually do. And often that's simply not the case. We previously referenced the principle described by the author of Ecclesiastes that even though there are substantial differences in life circumstances from one person to another, yet the prevailing struggles of life really come to us all in one fashion or another. The Greek philosopher Socrates articulated this same principle from a bit of a different angle, and the reality of what would happen if we could kind of trade places with someone else, when he wisely observed, quote, "If all misfortunes were laid in a common heap where everyone had to take an equal portion, most people would be contented to take their own and leave." I think there's incredible truth in that, that we would most likely not like to trade places with others as much as we think we would sometimes. In this same line of thought, it's an unspoken truth that we rarely, if ever, complain that it's unfair when we don't experience the same problems, the same difficulties, the same losses that other people do. We can all be very quick to kind of raise that no fair flag when others receive something that we'd like to have, but we tend not to feel that same sense of injury and injustice when others lose something of value and have it taken away. The account of the disciples James and John asking to be granted positions at the right hand and at the left hand of Christ is a good example of our typical focus on kind of the upside of fairness, if we can call it that. When they came and made their request of Christ, they were motivated by power and the glory that they felt it would be fair for them to share in because of their association with Christ, without really thinking much about sharing in what he needed to endure to qualify for it. Jesus' response to all the disciples, really, who had similar motivations and mindsets in this episode, provides a very meaningful antidote to the pitfalls of thinking about what we feel we deserve when we compare ourselves with others. Let's go to Mark 10. Mark chapter 10. And look at how Christ responded in this episode. Mark 10 will start in verse 42, which is right after this request was made. And this instruction that Jesus gave could really be kind of summarized in the ironic turnabout. Think about how you can serve instead of what you deserve. Mark 10, starting in verse 42, "But Jesus called them, the disciples, to himself and said to them, 'You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. For whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. For for the Son of God, who created all things, to become the Messiah, to give his life and service and his ransom for many. That wasn't very fair for him, was it, when we stop and think about it? Jesus was making the point that too often those who have something, whether it's possessions or authority or a position, aren't interested in fairness and sharing. His answer to that was not simply to be a little more fair or to share a little more, but to go beyond that and give, dare we say it, more than our fair share in service to others. There's a really profound passage in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus instructed us to have the same kind of approach in an even more personal way. Let's go to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5. Start in verse 38, Matthew 5:38. Jesus speaking, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth." That's fair, right? Wound for wound, stripe for stripe, gain for gain, loss for loss. Verse 39, "But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away." In these verses, Jesus is clearly saying to give more than our fair share physically. What about emotionally and in matters of the heart? Verse 43, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." That's fair, right? Verse 44, "But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, and do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." Now, we should hasten to clarify here that he wasn't saying that we are obligated to just, you know, endure constant physical and emotional abuse and broken relationships, or to have no personal boundaries. That's not what's intended here. But very ironically, for the thinking that comes naturally to us, what he was saying is that we should value fairness enough to accept unfairness when it comes to us in the normal course of life. Mr. Bornhorst referred to the same principle as described by the Apostle Paul in his sermon last week. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 6 and review that. 1 Corinthians 6. In verse 7, and this comes at the end of the section where Paul is writing about not taking other believers to the courts or using those methods to resolve disagreements. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 7, Paul writes, "Now therefore, it is already an utter failure for you that you go to law against one another. Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why do you not rather let yourselves be cheated?" And here again, what Paul wrote doesn't mean that we should just continually allow others to take advantage of us with no boundaries. We can have a whole separate sermon series on healthy boundaries in relationships. But what it does mean is that we have to be willing to accept some unfair outcomes in the same way that Christ has done for us. So to summarize this principle, there's really no purpose in wishing that life would be as fair for us as we think it is for others, because in many cases, it's not as fair for others as we think. That mental energy is much better spent thinking, as Christ instructed, about how we can serve instead of what we deserve. The third principle is to remember that many of this life's outcomes are as temporary as this life itself. Remember that many of this life's outcomes are as temporary as this life itself. In view of the realities of unfairness that we can expect to experience in this life, it can be very easy to stay focused on these things that aren't the way that they should be. And that can be a full spectrum, all the way from vast injustices, all the way down to minute inconveniences, and these things can just consume our thinking and our energy. rather than becoming discouraged to the point of losing hope, we should remember that there is a great cosmic balancing of the scales, if we can call it that, that is on the agenda when the kingdom of God is established. Now, to be clear, these principles aren't in any way meant to belittle the very legitimate difficulty and pain that unfairness can bring into our lives. Much to the contrary, we should acknowledge that reality and face it, not with cynical or selfish or defeatist responses, but rather by recognizing that God sees and hears and knows and understands these things, and that He can and will right these wrongs in His time. God's Word uses many, many contrasts to illustrate the various aspects of this human life and God's ultimate plans for humanity. On this topic of fairness and the balancing of scales that is to come, one of the most meaningful contrasts can be found by looking between what the author of Ecclesiastes describes about this life and something that Isaiah prophesied. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 1. Ecclesiastes 1. There's a very accurate description here of the limitations, the difficulties, the unevenness that we experience in this life. Ecclesiastes 1, starting in verse 14. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Why? Verse 15. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. Translation, life isn't fair. We can't solve all the problems. We can't heal all the hurts. We can't fix everything that's broken. Humanly, we just can't make everything the way that it should be. But a day is coming, wrote Isaiah, when God will do just that. Let's go to Isaiah 40. Isaiah chapter 40. A very inspiring and encouraging prophecy, Isaiah chapter 40, starting in verse 1, where Isaiah wrote, comfort, yes, comfort my people, says your God. Verse 3, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places smooth. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. We shouldn't necessarily conclude from this that God will reverse every little thing that we ever thought wasn't fair. But we should absolutely have confidence that there will be a reconciling of results for the outcomes in this life that truly matter. As we just rehearsed on the eighth day of the Feast of Tabernacles, nowhere is this reconciliation to come more profound than in the restoration of life itself to those who will still have an opportunity to know the God who created them, even though they didn't in this life. This basic but incredibly profound truth from God's plan of salvation is revealed through His feast, that every human being who has ever lived had or has or will have the same opportunity for eternal life in the family of God. So in the ultimate sense, or in the final analysis, the outcome of human life will be fair for every individual. So in the meantime, what can we do while we wait for that great balancing of the scales to come? The fourth principle is to remember that unfairness is another difficulty that can be converted into joy when we allow God to work in our lives through it. Remember that unfairness is another difficulty that can be converted into joy when we allow God to work in our lives through it. At the very beginning of James the Apostle, the Apostle's letter to the 12 tribes of Israel, he makes that statement that just stuns our sensibilities when we really think about it. Let's go to James 1, James chapter 1. and read verse 2. James 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. That doesn't sound very fair, does it? Doesn't feel very fair either. But we are told, count it all joy when you fall into trials. Why? Well, this instruction truly involves something that's much deeper than the face value of the statement itself. What he's describing is a process where God works within us over time. Trials, such as unfairness and many others, can be converted from their natural impact on us to joy as a fruit of the work that God is doing within us through His Spirit. As with so many other trials, we have to initially choose to have faith that the promised outcome is worth the difficulty of accepting and enduring unfairness when it comes. When we strive for that faith with God's help, we can have confidence that ultimately God's promises will be fulfilled, not just in a general, generic, impersonal kind of way, but in a way that's deeply fulfilling and meaningful for us as individuals as well. Let's go to Psalm 126. Psalm 126. There are a couple of verses here that really beautifully describe this process of converting trials into joy. Psalm 126, verse 5. Those who sow in tears shall reap in joy. A conversion process happens between those two things. Verse 6. He who continually goes forth weeping, bearing seed for sowing, being willing to let the conversion process work in their lives, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves, bringing the fruit, the reward of the effort of that work with him. So in conclusion, we've reviewed four basic principles that contribute to our human perspectives on both the perceived and real unfairness within the normal experience of life. In addition, we've also reviewed four principles that we can use to manage our own feelings and thoughts and actions on the topic of fairness. Let's conclude with a reminder that Paul shared with the Corinthians. It's very relevant for this topic. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians 4. And we'll read verse 7. In the New King James Version, this section in 2 Corinthians is titled, Cast Down but Unconquered. Unfairness for sure can make us feel cast down, but it need not make us feel conquered. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels. Earthen vessels could also be translated literally as clay pots. Think back to those tents that we were talking about. Something very temporary and imperfect and impermanent. But we have treasure within it, the spiritual and the relational treasure that God gives us. We have this treasure in earthen vessels. Why? That the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. Ultimately, like every other difficulty in this life, it is God who will deal with unfairness. He is using both the perceived and real experiences of unfairness in our lives to make our character more like His. In the final analysis of this world's happenings, the rights and the wrongs of this world will have been righted. But not before they have contributed, as Paul wrote here, to the excellence of God's power. That same power that He is planning to share with us as members of His family.